Welcome back to Techtopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Pamela McCordick. She is an author on AI. This is Techtopia. This episode of Technotopia is sponsored by CheapTranscription.io. CheapTranscription offers 10 cent per minute transcription using our happy robots or 85 cents per minute using our human assistants. CheapTranscription.io is cheaper and faster than everyone else. CheapTranscription.io. This episode of Technotopia is brought to you by Typewriter.plus. Typewriter.plus is a full-service editorial agency that brings amazing editors from places like the New York Times and TechCrunch to work on your writing. Need a blog post, a white paper, a presentation? The Typewriter team can write or edit anything on nearly any topic. Visit them at typewriter.plus for a free quote. That's typewriter.plus, typewriter.plus. Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Pamela McCordick. She's an author and a thinker on AI. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you worked on a book, This Could Be Important, Your Life and Times with the Artificial Intelligentsia. Tell us about that.
This is, in a way, a memoir, because I was in watching artificial intelligence from 1960 on. That's 1960.
Sure, sure, sure. I've heard of that. I think that's a star date, right?
Well, not many people had heard of it then. In fact, when I was invited to work on a book, I had to ask the authors, yeah, I'd like to work on your book. What's the topic? And they said, artificial intelligence. And I said, I've heard the term. Can you tell me what it's about? So I've been watching it ever since. It's kind of a big spectator sport for me.
Mm-hmm. So that's actually fascinating. So to talk about this, and I've been doing some reading on AI at that stage. I think a lot of the basis for today's machine learning was theorized back then, but you were unable to implement it, right? Something like that?
Oh, very much unable. The technology just wasn't there yet. And in fact, that's not what the first AI was all about. It was part of what the first AI was all about. But in the 1950s, which we're talking about, really, most people thought intelligence was what very smart people did, like play chess or play checkers or, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that it took intelligence to pursue something across, pursue prey across the landscape, let's say. No, that was instinct. That wasn't intelligence. Well, we've learned all of these are on a spectrum of intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting point. So originally they wanted these machines to be able to do very complex things. So is that?
Oh, absolutely.
What was the thinking? Why did they start so big?
Because that was what we thought intelligence was.
Okay.
Intelligence wasn't the other stuff. That any animal could do those other things,
mm-hmm.
but only humans could play chess or talk, answer questions, that kind of thing.
Hmm. And that's actually a fascinating delineation. I mean, that's the idea that we need the basic intelligent aspects of our personalities and our abilities to be able to do the more intelligent stuff. So
that's true. Yes.
Hmm. So what were they trying to do back then? What were they trying to build?
Oh, they had lots of ambitions. They were trying to prove theorems in, logic. They were trying to play chess. That was going to be it. You know, once you could play chess with a machine, mm-hmm. you had penetrated to the secret of intelligence.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds a little bit. I mean, I know some pretty unintelligent people who can play a pretty good game of chess. So that's kind of
exactly. I mean, think of the dinner partner you might have who's a chess expert. Thank you very much.
Interesting. So, what was the effort there? What was the goal? Was it just to think about the basis of intelligence?
The goal was really scientific. Many of these people were cognitive psychologists, and they wanted to be able to model human intelligence in ways that we couldn't before. And the computer offered a way of modeling intelligence that was dynamic, which, you just couldn't do with other kinds of things.
And what does it mean to modeled intelligence in that sense? Was the idea to have a working memory and a long-term memory, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I'm not even sure we had such fine delineations in those days. We wanted to make a machine, they wanted to make a machine that would imitate things that they had observed in psychological clinics. If a machine can memorize nonsense syllables the same way a human being can, we're getting closer to how human beings think.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point. It kind of reminds me of my third grade. I did a third grade science fair project about which is faster, the computer or human brain, and I had the computer do a bunch of math, and it was kind of obvious, but to me at third grade I was like, well, the computer can't do anything else but the math. The human brain is probably a lot more malleable and a lot more useful than just this Atari 800 XL that I was using or whatever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Hmm. So tell me about some of the characters back then. Were there any folks who really had some wild ideas?
Oh, everybody had wild ideas. They were rather sober in public, but mm-hmm. You got them talking after midnight. They had wild ideas. But the wild ideas have basically come to pass.
Mm-hmm.
They were wild, but they were right.
Give me an example of that. Where have you seen that somebody's gin fueled ramblings have become
nothing so elegant as gin. I'm afraid. Maybe a glass of sherry.
All right.
I can remember people saying, we're going to have machines that can tell what we're thinking, and I would look at them and say, no, that's really quite impossible. But we do have machines that know in many ways what people are thinking. They can read our faces. I had an example the other night. I was talking to a guy whose specialty is AI in education.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, it isn't just the machine saying, oh, you got that wrong. The real answer is X. What the machine does, it has a little camera, and it studies the face of the student, and it can tell whether the student is frustrated or angry or really challenged or any of those things. And it adjusts its teaching methods to accommodate exactly what that person is feeling. Now, that's pretty amazing.
So the original statement was that this professor said that they would know what we're thinking. But I think it's interesting that you're saying they know what we're feeling, which I don't know if I'm being too AI in the 1960s, but that sounds like sort of a dichotomy there.
No dichotomy. Feeling and thinking are very, very closely intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
Marvin Minsky, one of the founding fathers, wrote a book which said feeling emotions are what make us move ahead, because if we only had logic to rely on, we would quit the first time we got frustrated. No, we have feelings that we really want to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And so those feelings drive us forward.
Yeah, because I was imagining to myself, sure, we do have things that know what we're thinking. They predict what we're going to type. They predict when we need they tell us to stand up or they tell us to eat certain things, that sort of thing. But that's almost quantitative. What you're saying is a lot more emotional and a lot more fascinating.
And they are very much intertwined. It was a mistake, I would say, of the Greeks to divide reason from emotion.
Mm-hmm.
They are all part of the same package.
Wonderful. What do you think the future holds? You've seen the beginnings of this, the inklings of this, and it feels like now you're, I mean, if we're being honest, it's only probably a fraction or a single percentage point of what we've been looking for. And I mean, it's quite a bit actually. But where do we go from here?
Where do we go from here? Indeed. We're seeing AI move into so many fields that we never thought possible. I'm a writer. I've been a writer all my professional life. And I'm looking at programs that write very well. They mm-hmm. don't need my input. Or they can look at something I've written and say, yeah, you were going to finish that sentence this way. It kind of takes you aback.
Mm-hmm. But is that intelligence? So that's kind of like the chess game, right? That's the trick pony that clops its leg when it sees certain things.
Well, no, because we're talking about a much greater universe here. It's not clopping its heels. I know, clever Hans, you're talking
yep,
about.
Yep, yep.
It's not clopping its heels to say, yes, that's right, no, that's wrong. It's saying, Pamela, what you were going to say is the following, and never mind, I've done it for you. Oh, okay.
And does that bother you? You've seen things from the beginning to the end to today. Does it bother you that this thing is starting to think for you?
It's startling, but it doesn't bother me in the mm-hmm. sense of, I think I'm going to be obsolete. Maybe I will be, too late now. But what interests me is what you started out by talking about the good things that will happen in the future. Mm-hmm. I used to have long conversations with another founding father of AI called John McCarthy. Mm-hmm. John was at Stanford, and he did many, many things, and won all kinds of awards for those many things. But John used to say, Pamela, the big problem is the literary problem. And I'd say, what do you mean, John? And he'd say, to make a piece of literature, you have to have conflict. You have to have a villain. You have to have somebody who wins and somebody who loses. And sure, that makes a good story, but it's really not the way history has worked out. On the whole, technology has been very beneficial for humans. But we write about dystopian futures because that's the literary way we deal with these mm-hmm. things.
How can we write about a utopian future? I can't even imagine. I can't even think of a situation. Maybe Plato's utopia. I mean, I can't even think of a non-dystopian view of the future, especially in fiction. What's the conflict, I guess?
Well, the conflict is who will replace humans, and if humans are replaced, will these replacements share our values? And if they do or don't share our values, what are the implications of that? And so on and so forth, John. It's very, very complicated, as you can see.
What do we get replaced ultimately?
I don't think so, but hey, we might be the first species that doesn't get replaced. It's not that we'll get replaced. It's that we will occupy a special niche in the ecology, and the machines will be in a different niche, I believe.
Hmm. Is it symbiotic? Is it parasitic? Do we use the machines to help us survive, that kind of thing?
On the whole, I would say it's symbiotic. On the whole, I would say, we will use the machines to help us survive. They will be our helpers. Mm-hmm. They will extend the things that we like most about ourselves.
I mean, I think that's the situation now. We're being constantly extended by our cell phones. We're constantly being extended by online memory. I mean, when's the last time I've remembered a phone number, let alone an email address, I guess. So it's, right. They're already augmenting us to that degree.
Absolutely, yes.
What does the world look like in 20 years?
You know, I have made predictions in the past, and they were so short of the mark that I've really stopped doing it. It will be very different.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to see is human beings doing what they do best, and machines doing what they do best. So I'll give you an example. Elder care. There are things involved with taking care of elders or taking care of babies, for that matter, that only human beings can do.
Mm-hmm.
We smell to each other, pheromones and things like that. We have wonderful empathy or not, as the case may be, and so on. But there's lots of stuff that can be subcontracted out to the machines. And fine, let them do all that nonsense. Let them turn an elderly person over in bed so some poor caregiver doesn't put her back out. Let the machines do all kinds of things that they can do very well while we do the empathy and the compassion part.
Will a machine ever be able to do the empathy and compassion part sufficiently?
Why not?
That's the interesting point. What if you don't have a caretaker to come by and sense the humanity, the pheromones, as you say, which I mean, they're definitely associated with the sense of what you need, right? Are we ever going to outsource that to machines? Are we gonna have some little puppy machine that comes in and gives us a hug when we're feeling down?
Oh my gosh, we already do.
I think it's called an iPhone.
But actually there are furry robots that go into old people's homes in Japan and make them feel good.
Yeah, I remember there was the little seal, I think. There was a little, you could feed the seal and it would kind of purr and do all that good stuff.
Yeah. And we're hardwired to, be taken advantage of that way. Mm-hmm. And it's okay.
So the new book is about the history of AI since you started writing about it.
Yes, so almost 60 years.
Mm-hmm. What's kept you interested? I mean, aside from the obvious fact that we're replacing humans with these robots.
Well, for a long time, it was just the most interesting game in town. That's kept me interested, and I admire what's been done so much, and I am so delighted to see things go out into the world from AI. I'm going to give you an example. Mm-hmm. I went to hear Franz De Waal, who is a great primatologist. He studies the great apes and he studies chimpanzees and whatnot. I just went to hear what he had to say that was new about chimpanzees. This was at the 92nd Street Y in New York. And, he had a lot of interesting things to say, but the thing that just knocked me off my seat was, we really didn't know what questions to ask about our subjects, our animals, until AI told us what we should be asking. So there has been a whole mind change thanks to AI.
Interesting. So what was the AI telling them to ask?
Does the creature have goals? Well, yes, the creature has goals. Does it learn? Yes, the creature learns. Does it adapt autonomously to a very complex changing environment? Yes, it does. Boy, these are all the markers of intelligence. Mm-hmm. These creatures have intelligence.
And the same can be said to a degree about a machine learning algorithm that's able to pick out puppies on Google Photos, I guess you could say.
Yes, yes. Indeed.
Fascinating, yes. Fascinating. Well, this has been great. So the book is out now. The book is This Could Be Important: My Life and Times with the Artificial Intelligentsia. I'm going to grab it.
May I say why the title?
Yeah, please.
I spent a good part of my professional life, 40 years in New York City, pulling on the sleeves of public intellectuals and saying, artificial intelligence, this could be important. And they would just laugh. Exactly. Oh, please, come on.
Yeah. Machines think, please. Well, I mean, like, I think it, as a journalist now, as a tech journalist now, I think I'm kind of lucky because everybody says, obviously everything is computers. Like back in the, back when I started, I guess around 2000, the New York Times had one page dedicated to technology. Now you could argue almost every piece of news is associated with technology. So that's, so I guess we got lucky in that respect.
You could indeed. Yes.
Pamela, this has been wonderful. I'm looking forward to the book.
Okay. Thanks very much for talking with me, John.
All right. This is Technotopia. I'm John Biggs. We will see you next week. Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people.
Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.